Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program tonight...
It seems like that's... Why would anyone believe that, you know, the tax office was looking for a payment through cardless cash? But the reality is that these scams work because people get scared.
A new type of scam has emerged, according to the Australian Tax Office, and it involves cardless cash. We explore the story behind the scammers impersonating the ATO to make you part with your hard-earned cash. Also on the program...
So, for example, in Queensland, conflict transactions are only allowed if it's written into the document. So, for example, a conflict transaction might be nominating yourself as the beneficiary under a superannuation policy.
From our new podcast series, Money Dearest, we've been looking at estate planning and what documents people should have in place when they need to help in decision making. After all, who knows if they're going to get hit by a proverbial bus or have a sudden heart attack? All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, over the last 48 hours, we've been hearing that the markets had taken a plunge and that Donald Trump again could be the cause with his further salvo to China in their trade war. But is that all it is? And what if we are heading towards recession? I asked the chief economist at Perpetual, Matt Sherwood, to explain why the markets had become so skittish.
Well, obviously, the overarching sentiment has weakened in recent days with President Trump really upping the ante in his trade war battle with China. But in the domestic market, whilst that also has been a headwind, we've had some pretty soft economic data in Australia, and that's raising concerns about the state of the economy, the state of corporate earnings growth, and the Reserve Bank, of course, kept rates on hold in December. So they next meet in February. So probably the market was a bit disappointed with that result also.
Has there been any effect with some of the bad figures coming through for agriculture?
Well, there's not major exposure in Australia in the agriculture space. There is obviously some listed companies there, but it's just part of this weakening sentiment. Yes, weak farming output from the drought, combined with the housing downturn that we're seeing, the general decline in business confidence and business investment. And, of course, households are dealing with highly indebted balance sheets, and so they're constraining their spending. And it looks like real spending, at least in October, looks like it's fallen. And so, overall, you know, the economy's fairly weak on a number of fronts. And the RBA has tried to combat this by lowering interest rates, and the Morrison government gave $8 billion of tax cuts. But all those two things seem to have combined to generate is a higher savings rate. So it looks like Australians are becoming more more cautious about what they spend. And this is having big flow-through effects throughout all sectors of the economy.
So people paying down debt, basically.
Yes, they're using the opportunity of lower rates rather than to increase their spending, but really to continue to pay down what is a large portion or a large amount of debt. And they obviously got the tax cuts from the Morrison government, said thanks very much, and just whacked that off the mortgage also. So, you know, there has been a progressive slowing in the domestic economy. Unemployment's going up. So the economy is certainly stuck in the sluggish or the slow lane at the moment, and it's very hard to see what's going to get it out of us, at least in the near term.
So could we be looking at recession?
Well, you'd probably say that, you know, the Australian economy hasn't had a recession in over 28 years, so it's overdue for one. And, you know, a lot of these factors are leading to an outlook of weaker growth. Whether it leads to contraction or not, say, it's a bit of a difficult call to make. But you'd have to say this. You'd have to say that recession risks are rising. But, of course, we have a a couple of policy tools still left that we can throw at it. First one's the currency, and obviously the big one which Australia has, which few other countries do, is the state of the government balance sheet, a government with very low debt. And so at the appropriate time, we'd be looking for the Morrison government to provide more stimulus to the economy, because it's pretty clear that the Reserve Bank is out of policy ammunition.
What about quantitative easing? Is there anything that we can do with that?
Well, I'm not convinced about the merits of quantitative easing. You'd have to sit there and say, well, Phil Lowe last week, the RBA governor, said that his preferred method of quantitative easing is buying government bonds in the secondary market. But government bond yields are already incredibly low in this nation. They're down to about 1%. So you'd be having to ask, what kind of stimulus would buying government bonds and forcing those yields even lower? What kind of programs and investments are you trying to trigger here? They'd be pretty low quality ones. And I would argue that outside 2008, quantitative easing has proved to be ineffective in lifting growth, lifting investment, and lifting inflation. So to me, I don't believe that quantitative easing will be the policy solution the Australian economy is looking for. I think a far more logical solution is increased fiscal stimulus. You know, government's already driving the entire growth rate in the Australian economy that we saw in the September quarter. They added 0.4, and that was the economy's total growth rate. So in the end, it may come to a point where the Morrison government has to probably cut taxes and bring forward tax cuts to give a bit of income relief to households, particularly if it's aimed at low and middle income earners. They would have the higher propensity to spend and to boost the economy and, of course, most importantly, create jobs.
So would they also bring forward infrastructure projects then?
Well, the challenge with infrastructure is there's already a hell of a lot of infrastructure going on in Australia. And government investment is quite elevated, particularly by state government. So you'd be wondering, you know, would the government be better suited, rather than doing even more infrastructure, to actually try to provide some other form of support to the domestic economy, say through tax cuts or other spending measures. The challenge also with infrastructure investment is that it takes a long time for it to get moving. And I think it's pretty clear from the national accounts which were released yesterday, the economy needs some support in the near term rather than in, you know, 12 to 36 months out. And that's when infrastructure spending would begin to impact activity. So I suspect probably something earlier is needed than infrastructure, but infrastructure is still throwing flu the system, and hence if we provided a little bit more support to domestic incomes, that might be able to hit the economy from two directions to try to boost demand, employment growth, and generally lift growth.
And just lastly, you talked earlier a bit about the exchange rate being one of the levers that we could be pulling, but it's the exchange rate's gone up just recently, hasn't it?
Well, the Australian currency really has been in a downward trend for the past 2 years or so, but really since since July, August, the currency's pretty much gone sideways, and it has moved up slightly from the lows we saw in October. But clearly I would imagine the RBA would be disappointed that the currency is still around 68 US cents. They would much prefer it in the mid-60s or even less to give a bit more support to the export sector, which of course is doing particularly well at the moment. Not only are they exporting more volumes of raw materials, which is obviously good for the economy, but also commodity prices are very high, so it's providing a lot of national income to the economy. This is the primary reason the budget is now in surplus. But if we could get the currency a bit lower, it certainly would lift growth, would lift national income, but I would imagine there wouldn't be too much flow through to the employment sector because, you know, within the Australian economy, whilst, you know, sectors such as rural production and minerals is incredibly important, it's not a huge employer relative to the services sectors we see in the major cities. So, you know, I don't think there would be a big employment lift if the currency was lower, but of course it's kind of like free growth, so they're the sort of growth you particularly like when the economy's growing in a very anemic fashion like it is now.
Matt Sherwood, Chief Economist at Perpetual, speaking with me there. This is On The Money, and I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to me throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network.
On The Money, ride the gravy train with us.
A new twist on an old scam is sweeping the nation, just in time for the holiday season, according to the ATO. On Tuesday, the tax office announced an uptick in scammers impersonating them to trick victims into giving them money via cardless cash payments. But how big is this scam really? Why is it gaining in size now? And why do people fall for it? Well, Ryan Stanton has the story.
This year, scammers have raked in over $2 million so far by impersonating the Australian Taxation Office and making use of new technologies, such as cardless cash. On Tuesday, the tax office released a warning highlighting a wave of scams utilising this technology and emphasising caution in dealing with potentially fraudulent callers. The scam, which has seen a spike in the lead-up to the holiday season, involves scammers calling the victims, claiming to be from the tax office, and demanding overdue payment. If this type of scam sounds familiar to you, that's because it is. According to Editor-in-Chief and tech expert for Finder.com.au, Angus Kidman, the scheme has its origins in familiar hustles.
The cardless cash scam is a new variant on a scam that's been going on for a long time where a scammer rings you up and they say, oh, you've got a tax debt, you need to pay it immediately, and this is how I want to get the money from you. And there was a time when they would do this by asking for gift cards for iTunes or things like that, because they were things that once they're very hard to trace and they're a source of money. But the new variation of this is with cardless cash. So they say, we need this immediately, and the best way to do this payment is go and set up a cardless cash payment for us. So cardless cash has been around for a couple of years now, and it lets you withdraw money from an ATM even if you don't have a card. You just go through your banking app and say, hey, I want to withdraw this money. It gives you a code. You go and type that in. So what the scammer says is, you need to set this up, give me the code, and that's how you're going to pay your debt. And yeah, then they go grab the money and race off with it and live happily ever after on your hard-gained money.
Unfortunately, the amount of hard-gained money these scammers receive is likely to increase before the end of the year, according to the ATO. In October, scammers distributed messages purporting to be from the ATO that asked users to update their personal details, something which scammers may now be exploiting in this new scheme. Similarly, $2 million was fleeced from unsuspecting citizens in November to January alone at the tail end of last year in scams that impersonated the ATO. Part of this, according to Karen Foat, Assistant Commissioner of the ATO, is that the tax office does follow up outstanding debts around this time of year. Speaking with the publication Financial Review, Ms. Foat was quoted as saying, "People who have tax returns with debts would be expecting to start needing to pay for those around this time of year. That makes it more likely that they could fall for a scam." On the other hand, Angus Kidman notes that there is no specific time that these scammers prioritise and that they're an ongoing problem.
I think there's some evidence that suggests you sort of get these peaks and troughs. So this notion that perhaps as we get towards the end of the year and people are running around and feeling busy in the rush of Christmas, that maybe they won't think about it as hard. But there's no other real logical reason why you do it at one time. And we do see that these scams are an ongoing problem. These kind of calls happen all the time. So I think it is something people need to be aware of sort of throughout the year. And that while we might see some peaks and troughs in that activity, the reality is that because they succeed as criminal enterprises, these things go on all the time.
Kidman's note that these things succeed may surprise some who view themselves as too smart or too savvy to be scammed. But the reality is that these scams persist for a reason. Speaking to the New Daily, Deakin University consumer behaviour expert Paul Harrison notes similarities between the tactics of scams and marketing. The main issue, he says, is that it's easier to believe than not to believe. Another key reason people fall for these scams, according to Kidman, is fear.
It's interesting. Obviously, it seems like that. Why would anyone believe that, you know, the tax office was looking for a payment through cardless cash? But the reality is that these scams work because people get scared. They believe that they're in trouble. And so even if 90% of people hang up, there's going to be that 10% who fall for it.
According to data provided by ScamWatch, those who do fall for it make up a sizable group. By October of this year, the ACCC had received over 140,000 reports of scams, with close to $120 million in reported losses. Incidents involving cardless cash, however, only make up a small portion of reported scams. A spokesperson from the ACCC noted that there were 78 reports where cardless cash was in the description or payment method this year, and only 7 of these related to the ATO. Scams involving cardless cash need not be limited to involving this type of impersonation, and these impersonation scams are far from the only type of scam. Angus Kidman has some examples of other scams to watch out for.
So on top of that, yeah, the cardless cash is an interesting new one. We're still seeing a lot of scam calls, which will be for someone saying, oh, we're from the NBN. And we're about to disconnect you if you don't pay us immediately. Now, this is nonsense because the NBN doesn't connect consumers directly anyway. You always do that by going to an internet service provider. But that's one that is servicing quite a lot. And there's a classic scam that's been going for years, which is where you get a phone call from someone trying to be more friendly, and they say, oh, we've detected a problem on your computer. We want you to help you remove this virus. And in fact, it's the reverse. What they're actually trying to do is to get you to install software so they can take control of your machine, and then they're going to try and hit you up with ransomware to get that money back. So that one is still going around. And this is why, yeah, my advice to people is, like, the second something sounds suspicious, like, don't even engage with them, just hang up. Because the reality is that in this day and age, unfortunately, if you get a call like that, it's far more likely to be a scam than to be anything else, to be anything real.
Knowing the types of scams can help you identify them. But Kidman notes that there are other ways to protect yourself if you're unsure about a contact.
So, well, the first thing is that if someone is demanding immediate payment through an unusual method, then that's problematic. But in fact, if you receive a phone call and someone says, oh, we're from such and such, the first thing is to say, well, I need to be able to confirm that. Can you give me a number I can call you back on? If it happened to be a genuine message from a tax office, the bank, they will do that. If it's a scammer, they're either going to hang up immediately or they're going to say, no, we don't have time for that. You need to do this now. So if you just ask that question up front and they don't want to answer it, that's a surefire sign that it's a scam.
Similarly, the ATO has released a list of things they will never do when they contact you, including threaten you with immediate jail time, arrests or deportation, request payment of a debt via cardless cash, iTunes or Google Play cards, prepaid Visa cards, cryptocurrency, or direct credit to a personal bank account, and send an email or an SMS requesting you click on a hyperlink to log on to government services. So the next time you get a message from the ATO about that debt you might owe, maybe double check before you direct debit them the cash.
Ryan Stanton there, ending that report. You're listening to On The Money, around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
From Hobart to Alice Springs, from Woodend to Taree, this is On The Money, making sense out of all those dollars.
From our new podcast series, Money Dearest, we've been looking at estate planning and what documents people should have in place when they need to help in decision making. After all, you could get hit by a proverbial bus, you could have a sudden heart attack or other serious health event, or someone close to you could also have the same. I asked Senior Associate at Hall & Wilcox, Kate Gould, to explain exactly what a power of attorney was.
A power of attorney is a document whereby the principal appoints an attorney to stand in their shoes and to manage their legal and financial affairs on their behalf. And it is a document that you can choose when it starts. It can basically start straight away once the principal hands over the power of attorney to the attorney. Or another common time when it would start is only if the principal loses mental capacity, as evidenced by a medical practitioner.
And that's often what we're using it for these days, isn't it? For people, when we're talking about elderly people, for when they need someone to make decisions on their behalf.
That's right.
We get on the top of the form sometimes enduring power of attorney. Can you explain the differences there?
Of course. So an enduring power of attorney is a document that continues to be effective if the principal one day loses mental capacity. And there's a trick, because sometimes there are old enduring powers of attorney, but they're only called general power of attorney. And this was legislation going back to about 2003. They were all called general powers of attorney. But if you look very carefully and with legal advice, you can actually see that in the document there is language to denote that it actually is an enduring power of attorney. But in the context of what we're discussing, it's crucial that people have enduring powers of attorney, because it's when you lose capacity that you actually need assistance in someone to help you manage your financial and legal affairs.
Yes, because powers of attorney, you could give someone a power of attorney to look after a unit that you own when you're overseas.
Correct.
Maybe you're overseas for 6 months or 12 months and you want someone to look after it for you. So you can say, that's just for that purpose, isn't it?
That's right. You can give general powers of attorney for a specific purpose, and exactly that example you mentioned. It can be for a limited time or for a particular asset, or only if the principal is out of the jurisdiction of Australia.
And there's really kind of no rules when it comes to writing one, isn't there? I mean, it's like it's a blank sheet of paper.
Well, there
what?
Are some
what
do you, rules.
What are some
so,
of the rules?
Firstly, each state is different, but I'll just hone it in.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Yes, we've got different legislation.
That's right. So, yes. So there are some states where it's very broad, where basically the language is such that anything that you could do yourself, your attorney can do on your behalf. But there are some exceptions in New South Wales. For example, if you want to make a gift, you can only do that if it's written into the power of attorney. If you want to benefit someone else other than yourself, that must be written into the power of attorney, otherwise it's invalid. So let me give you an example. So if the principal is in the habit of making charitable gifts or gifts when it comes to special occasions in the immediate family, such as a birth or a wedding, and they lose capacity, but it's written into their power of attorney that they authorise the giving of gifts, well, then their attorney can use the principal's money to make gifts on behalf of the principal. They cannot do that unless that language is specifically in the document. Another instance of when an act needs to be written into a New South Wales power of attorney is where the principal allows the attorney to use the principal's money for their reasonable living and medical expenses. So, for instance, in a couple situation, they generally would be quite comfortable with their spouse accessing their money to look after their reasonable living and medical needs. That cannot occur unless that's specifically written into the document.
And in other states, it's different in some way?
In other states, it's
different.
In many ways.
Oh.
So, for example, in Queensland, conflict transactions are only allowed if it's written into the document. So, for example, a conflict transaction might be nominating yourself as the beneficiary under a superannuation policy. That might be a conflict at first glance, but if it's a couple situation, for instance, and that complements their estate planning, well, that's a conflict that is actually allowable and makes sense in that context. So there are certain situations where there can be conflict transactions that certainly are not allowed, no matter what the situation. But in other states like Queensland, if it's written into the document and allowed, well, then that conflict is okay.
And now this is going to be a bit of a silly question for you probably, but if I have made a power of attorney here in Sydney and we move to the Gold Coast and we have to enact the provisions in the power of attorney, which laws are we operating under?
That's a really good question. So as a starting point, there's general cross-recognition of powers of attorney, so that if you made one while you were living in New South Wales and then you relocated to Queensland, it would be operational and effective in Queensland.
Right, so it's as we had made it here.
Correct.
In New South Wales.
That's right.
And what we understood when we were making it here in New South Wales.
That's right.
And that's the same in other states.
That's right.
Yeah. So really, it's quite difficult for legal practitioners then, because you've got to find out, where did you make this power of attorney, don't you?
That's right. And sometimes it might be warranted just to update the powers of attorney and the guardianship documents to the state that the client has relocated to, just to make sure that everything is tidied up and in the best possible situation now that they've moved.
Also, a common problem I've come across in doing this series is that people confuse what a power of attorney can and can't do. We've been describing it as something that if it looks after your financial and legal affairs, really, and the other document being the guardianship just is to look after your health and well-being or welfare, perhaps.
That's correct. A lot of people bundle it under the same term, but it's quite a clear distinction. A power of attorney is for financial and legal matters, whereas an appointment of guardian is for healthcare-only matters. So it might be that the client appoints the same people to do the same jobs, but they're completely different documents and they're completely different functions.
Senior Associate at Hall & Wilcox, Kate Gould, speaking with me there. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers. And that's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producer Ryan Stanton this week. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 for the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And you can find our shows and stories at 2cr.com/onthemoney. You can subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter. Look for at onthemoney2ser. Also find us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.